This is Free Thought Radio with co-hosts Dan Barker and Annie Laurie Gaylor. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews.
Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try.
Steps you want if you have cleared them with the pontiff. Everybody say his own, Kyrie eleison, doing that again, right?
Hi, I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor. Welcome, April. It's got to be an improvement over March. And as you probably guessed, that's Tom Lehrer, a teaser of his classic Vatican Rag. And we're going to be ragging on the Vatican influence on our Supreme Court on today's show.
And I'm Dan Barker, your friendly neighborhood atheist of the airwaves. This is the April 5th, 2014 broadcast of Free Thought Radio, which is produced right here in Madison, Wisconsin, which is the national headquarters of the Freedom From Religion Foundation. We broadcast also in other stations around the country, including in Texas, in Missouri, in Michigan. You might be hearing us somewhere in New York State, in California. And then the following week, we podcast throughout the universe.
Free Thought Radio is the weekly production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, and FFRF now has over 20,000 members in North America. We have more than 150,000 Facebook friends. We're over 20K on Twitter followers. But don't just follow us, don't just friend us. Join us today in our work to keep religion out of government and the promotion of free thought. And if you are a member of FFRF, you get our 10 times a year issue of Free Thought Today, and we stay in touch and tell you what we do with your modest dues, which are deductible for income tax purposes. So join us at FFRF.org.
Today, we're going to talk with Indre Viscontas. Believe it or not, she is a neuroscientist, an educator, a TV host, a podcast host, and an opera singer.
And an atheist, multi-talented from San Francisco. So we'll hear some of her opera music, and she'll tell us about her research into music and the brain.
And this week is the birthday of the irreverent songwriter Tom Lehrer, who we just heard a little bit of. He was born on April the 9th, 1928. We'll play some of his music in a few minutes.
Now, as you know, if you're a regular listener of Free Thought Radio, we do like to parse the oral arguments at the Supreme Court when there is an Establishment Clause case before them, law dealing with the separation of religion from government. And as you probably know, a week ago, the U.S. Supreme Court heard oral arguments, March 25th, on one of the biggest cases of its session called Sebelius versus Hobby Lobby, Hobby Lobby Stores and Conestoga Wood Specialties Corporations. And this case is about for-profit corporations that are arguing that their corporations have a religious right to be excluded from the Affordable Care Act's requirements that they offer insurance coverage with preventive medical services, including contraception. And right now, actual churches and church denominations are exempted from offering this coverage. And we have more than 70 lawsuits by religious schools and hospitals, most of them Catholic, that are complaining that they don't want to have to sign a waiver that they object to such coverage. And if they sign this waiver, insurance companies will pick up that coverage. But now we have this third layer of protest. It's for-profit corporations crying that they have a religion, that they exercise religion, and that their religious rights are being violated by Obamacare's contraceptive mandate. And the head of Hobby Lobby is a religious zealot who wants to pick and choose which forms of contraception he deems are acceptable for his thousands of women employees. And despite scientific evidence to the contrary, he deems the pill and the IUD to be, quote, abortifacients, and he claims his religious rights are being violated by the fact that his women employees have full medical coverage of any form of contraception they like.
If you heard our interview a few weeks ago with the attorney Marcy Hamilton, you'll know that Hobby Lobby is claiming that the Religious Freedom Restoration Act gives their company the right to defy Obamacare and to determine which forms of contraception his employees can use. So some of the oral arguments were pretty abstruse.
So we're going to give you the better stuff. And I did feel so proud of all three women Supreme Court justices. They're all sharp cookies, needless to say. And you know, there are only three women out of nine on the bench. And out of the nine Supreme Court justices, six are Roman Catholic. Four Roman Catholics are arch-conservatives, Scalia, Thomas, Alito, and Roberts. And one Catholic, Kennedy, is our swing vote. As you may know, he voted for gay marriage last term. One of the six Roman Catholic justices, fortunately, is a feminist. And let's start with the opening salvo from Sonia Sotomayor to Paul Clement, who argued for Hobby Lobby.
Your claim limited to sensitive materials like contraceptives, or does it include items like blood transfusion, vaccines, for some religions, products made of pork? Any claim under your theory that has a religious basis, could an employer preclude the use of those items as well?
Then Clement hemmed and hawed over that question. He never really answered it. So Justice Elena Kagan took up where Sotomayor left off and asked him specifically about whether a for-profit corporation could deem that it had a religious objection to employees, for example, having medical health care coverage for blood transfusions.
Blood transfusions, again, each one of these cases, I think, would have to be evaluated on its own and the compelling interest, least restrictive alternative test, and the substantial burden.
So really, every medical treatment, and Justice Sotomayor is quite right, that there are quite a number of medical treatments that different religious groups object to. So one religious group could opt out of this, and another religious group could opt out of that, and everything would be piecemeal, and nothing would be uniform.
Everything would be piecemeal, everything would be challenged. So amen, sister to that astute observation. And now I felt so proud of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who quietly has so much backbone, and she pointed out something very important.
This was a law that was passed overwhelmingly, both houses of Congress. People from all sides of the political spectrum voted for it. There was an effort to adopt the conscience amendment, a specific conscience amendment in 2012. And the Senate rejected that. That amendment would have enabled secular employers, insurance providers, to deny coverage on the basis of religious beliefs or moral convictions. It was specifically geared to secular employers and insurance providers, and that was rejected.
Justice Kagan then built on Ginsburg's point.
But again, Mr. Clement, as Justice Ginsburg said, this was a very uncontroversial law. Your understanding of this law, your interpretation of it, would essentially subject the entire U.S. Code, highest test in constitutional law, to a compelling interest standard. So another employer comes in, and that employer says, I have a religious objection to sex discrimination laws. And then another employer comes in. I have a religious objection to minimum wage laws. And then another, family leave. And then another, child labor laws. And all of that is subject to the exact same test, which you say is this unbelievably high test, the compelling interest standard with the least restrictive alternative.
You hear the growing incredulity in Justice Kagan's voice as she tries to reason with the Hobby Lobby attorney.
If your argument were adopted and there was a strict scrutiny standard of the kind that usually applies and a restrictive alternative requirement, then you would see religious objectors come out of the woodwork with respect to all of these laws.
She's right. To repeat, you would see religious objectors coming out of the woodwork with respect to all of these laws.
Justice Kagan repeatedly made an argument to Hobby Lobby, which kept trying to say that Hobby Lobby has a substantial burden imposed on it because its Christian owner doesn't agree with the contraceptive mandate, basically wants to push his nose into his employees' bedrooms. Kagan pointed out that corporations don't even have to offer health care. If they don't, then they pay what is not a penalty, but a tax. As the Supreme Court has ruled, the Affordable Care Act is constitutional because it is a tax.
But Hobby Lobby could choose not to provide health insurance at all. So there's a choice here. It's not even a penalty, by in the language of the statute. It's a payment or a tax. There's a choice. And so the question is, why is there a substantial burden at all?
It's a good question. Now, here's Justice Kagan making another very firm point.
Isn't that just a way of saying that you think that this isn't a good statute because it asks one person to subsidize another person? But Congress has made a judgment, and Congress has given a statutory entitlement, and that entitlement is to women and includes contraceptive coverage. And when the employer says, I don't want to give that, that woman is quite directly, quite tangibly harmed.
Women in the Constitution would be tangibly harmed. There are only three women on the high court. Good as they are, they ain't a majority. The swing vote undoubtedly will go to Justice Anthony Kennedy. In questioning Clement on behalf of Hobby Lobby, Kennedy made one very remarkable statement, made my heart sore.
How would you suggest that we think about the position and the rights of the employees? And you can have hypotheticals about the employer makes them, wants to make them wear burkas and so forth. That's not in this case. But in a way, the employees are in a position where the government, through its health care plan, under your view, is telling the employer to put the employee in a disadvantageous position. The employee may not agree with these religious beliefs of the employer. Does the religious beliefs just trump? Is that the way it works?
So does the religious beliefs just trump? That's Kennedy's question, but unfortunately, he made this chilling remark during the oral arguments to Donald B. Varelli, Jr., who appeared on behalf of the government in support of the contraceptive mandate.
You say profit corporations just don't have any standing to vindicate the religious rights of their shareholders and owners.
Say that again. Justice Kennedy is worried that corporations just don't have any standing to vindicate the religious rights of their shareholders and owners. They have all the religious rights they need. They can worship freely. If they don't want to use birth control, they don't have to. Since when did the religious right concept translate to the right to dictate to others a religion that they reject?
So now here's one of those five ultra-Catholic justices on the Supreme Court, Chief Justice John Roberts.
Isn't that what we're talking about in terms of their beliefs? Their religious beliefs is that they have to pay for these four methods of contraception that they believe provide abortion.
So that's the aha, the big moment. The A word dropped by Chief Justice Roberts, not talking about abortifacients or contraception anymore, bringing up abortion. And here's where Virilli did get in one good lick.
With all due respect, about 2 million women who rely on the IUD as a method of birth control in this country, I don't think they think that they are engaged in abortion in doing that. It is their belief. It's sincere. We respect it.
So it's hard to feel confident about the outcome, but there's some speculation that there will be some complicated plurality decision here that might not be completely destructive to women's employees' right to determine for themselves the contraception they use. But clearly, it's grossly unfair for women's reproductive rights to hinge on a Supreme Court with only three women and six out of the nine Roman Catholics. One predatory religion and one gender have way too much power on the highest court of a secular country.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor.
I'm Dan Barker.
We will be back to have some music of Tom Lehrer, and then we're going to talk with the multi-talented neuroscientist, opera singer, science educator, music educator, and TV host, and atheist, Indre Viscontis.
And we're back with more Free Thought Radio. I'm Dan Barker.
This is Annie Laurie Gaylor.
And this is a little bit of the Vatican Rag by Tom Lehrer. Tom Lehrer, the irreverent songwriter, he was a math professor, is a math professor. He was born in April the 9th, 1928. And I've never heard this version of his song that he produced from a live recording. So let's play it for the first time on Free Thought Radio. Tom Lehrer singing the Vatican Rag.
Another big news story of the year concerned the Ecumenical Council in Rome, known as Vatican II. Among the things they did, in an attempt to make the church more commercial, to introduce the vernacular into portions of the Mass to replace Latin, and to widen somewhat the range of music permissible in the liturgy. But I feel that if they really want to sell the product, in this secular age, what they ought to do is to redo some of the liturgical music in popular song forms. I have a modest example here. It's called The Vatican Rag. First you get down on your knees, fiddle with your rosaries, bow your head with great respect and genuflect, genuflect, genuflect. Do whatever steps you want if you have cleared them with the pontiff. Everybody say his own Kyrie eleison, doing the Vatican Rag. Processional, step into that small confessional. There, the guy who's got religion will tell you if your sin's original. If it is, try playing it safer. Drink the wine and chew the wafer. 2, 4, 6, 8. Time to transubstantiate. So get down upon your knees, fiddle with your rosaries, bow your head with great respect and genuflect, genuflect, genuflect. Make a cross on your abdomen. When in Rome, do like a Roman. Ave Maria, Jesus. It's good to see you getting ecstatic and sort of dramatic and doing the Vatican Rag.
And that's Tom Lehrer singing his own song, The Vatican Rag. I do that song too, but I can't sing the song fast as he did. If you want to hear Tom Lehrer singing really fast, listen to how he goes through all of the elements in the periodic table.
There's antimony, arsenic, aluminum, selenium, and hydrogen, and oxygen, and nitrogen, and rhenium, and nickel, neodymium, neptunium, germanium, and iron, americium, ruthenium, uranium, europium, zirconium, lutetium, vanadium, and lanthanum, and osmium, and astatine, and radium, and gold, protactinium, and indium, and gallium, and iodine, and thorium, and thulium, and thallium. There's yttrium, ytterbium, actinium, rubidium, and boron, gadolinium, niobium, iridium, and strontium, and silicon, and silver, and samarium, and bismuth, bromine, lithium, beryllium, and barium. There's holmium and helium and hafnium and erbium and phosphorus and francium and fluorine and terbium and manganese and mercury, molybdenum, magnesium, dysprosium and scandium and cerium and cesium and lead, praseodymium and platinum, plutonium, indium, promethium, potassium, polonium and tantalum, technetium, titanium, tellurium and cadmium and calcium and chromium and curium. There's sulfur, californium, and fermium, berkelium, and also mendelevium, einsteinium, nobelium, and argon, kryptonium, radon, xenon, zinc, and rhodium, and chlorine, carbon, cobalt, copper, tungsten, tin, and sodium. These are the only ones of which the news has come to Harvard. And there may be many others, but they haven't been Harvard.
That's really cute. Oliver Sacks would like that. He goes around with a periodic table in his pocket, you know. Well, now, for more entertainment.
Going from the small elements to the large.
To the universe. We did not celebrate the birthday last week of Eric Idle. And this is the galaxy song that he helped write from The Meaning of Life.
Whenever life gets you down, Mrs. Brown, and things seem hard or tough, and people are stupid, obnoxious or daft, and you feel that you've had quite enough, just remember that you're standing on a planet that's evolving, and revolving at 900 miles an hour. It's orbiting at 90 miles a second, so it's reckoned a sun that is the source of all our power. The sun and you and me and all the stars that we can see are moving at a million miles a day. In an outer spiral arm at 40,000 miles an hour of the galaxy we call the Milky Way. Our galaxy itself contains 100 billion stars. It's 100,000 light years side to side. It bulges in the middle, 16,000 light years thick, but out by us it's just 3,000 light years wide. We're 30,000 light years from galactic central point. We go round every 200 million years. And our galaxy is only one of millions of billions in this amazing and expanding universe.
And that's Eric Idle singing the Galaxy Song. So stay tuned for more Free Thought Radio. I'm Dan Barker with Annie Laurie Gaylor.
And our guest will be
Indre Viscontis. She is a neuroscientist, a science educator, a podcast host,
an opera singer.
And an opera singer and a TV co-star.
And an atheist.
And an atheist. So stay tuned for more Free Thought Radio.
As Mark Twain said, faith is believing what you know ain't so. This is Free Thought Radio.
I'm Dan Barker.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor.
And a few weeks ago, we interviewed on Free Thought Radio Chris Johnson, the photographer and the producer of the book A Better Life, 100 Atheists Speak Out on Joy and Meaning in a World Without God. And as we were looking through that gorgeous book, we found pictures and interviews of some really interesting people, including on page 92, Dr. Indre Viscontis, who is a multi-talented person in many ways, an opera singer. She is a science educator. She has a PhD in science. She's a TV host. Many things. Right now, she's on the collegiate faculty of the San Francisco Conservatory of Music, where she teaches studies and how to apply the principles of neuroscience to develop effective and efficient practice strategies. She also is affiliated with the Memory and Aging Center at UCSF, and she also teaches, those of you who like the great courses, the lectures on 12 essential concepts of science in the great courses.
12 essential scientific concepts dives into the core concepts of science and broadens your understanding of the fundamental role they play in the world around you. Your guide is award-winning professor and cognitive neuroscientist Indre Viscontis, who has a knack for making science clear and engaging.
Science is being used to shape our decisions every single day. Step back and take a broad view so that you can apply it to your own life and you can apply it to things that are relevant.
You'll learn how brain plasticity makes it easier for you to get rid of bad habits, understand how the Big Bounce could possibly replace the Big Bang Theory, and see how the power of a tropical cyclone is equivalent to detonating a nuclear bomb every 20 minutes. Topics that may have seemed impossible in school are brought to life through fascinating illustrations and engaging lectures in a way that sticks.
Join me for a thrilling tour of some of the most important scientific ideas of all time.
12 Essential Scientific Concepts, taught by Professor Indre Viscontis. Order it now from The Great Courses.
So we have Dr. Indre Viscontis on the phone today with us from San Francisco. Welcome to Free Thought Radio.
Thank you very much. You guys are already making me blush.
Well, and did we say you have a PhD from UCLA in cognitive neuroscience? So you're a Renaissance woman.
That's sort of something that I've striven for. I always thought a PhD is a really wonderful way to get a broad base of knowledge and the way that the brain and the mind interact and how they work.
Well, see, also with music, because music is such an important part of the human species. Dr. Sachs, Oliver Sachs, thinks we should call ourselves the musical species because that's what sets us apart. So you as an opera singer who does music and as a scientist who studies the brain in music, how does all that fit together?
Well, music is my passion, and it's where my heart was ever since I was a little child. But I also realized that it would be very difficult to make a living as a musician. And in fact, if you look at the number of artists who have secondary jobs, musicians by far outweigh all the other artistic domains. It's very hard to make a living only from music. So I decided that I wanted to get a background in psychology, in part because I felt that it would really inform my music. It would help me understand why certain characters in opera are more compelling than others and how to bring that forward to the audience. So in a way, I always saw the two as being on par, but I never imagined that they would become so intertwined as they are today, where I'm actually teaching neuroscience to music students at the conservatory you know, and really trying to apply what we know about the brain to how we can become better musicians.
Well, you know, I'm a professional musician too, on the side, and of course our joke at the gigs is always, don't quit your job. And for and you know what's nice about that is that you don't have to do it. We get to pick the gigs that we want to do. So we're there because we really enjoy it. And I bet it's the same for you. You're doing it because you love to, not because you have to.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, I have to because it's the only way that I can really feel fulfilled and be very happy. But I don't have to in order to eat. You know, I do other things that can put food on the table and pay my mortgage. So you're right. I get to choose projects that are artistically fulfilling for me instead of having to take jobs that, you know, simply bring in a paycheck.
Now, when we go out of this break, I do want to put a teaser that we will hear Indre Viscontes singing from an opera, and we'll have play a little more of your music later in the show.
But tell us about the ensemble project. Did you start that there in San Francisco?
I did. You know, about a year ago, I was giving a talk on music in the brain at UCSF. And a woman approached me after the talk, and she said that she's the head of a private foundation and that she really enjoyed what I had to say and, you know, what would be a project that I would want to do that she might want to fund. And thus began a great friendship and the birth of this ensemble project. She had already funded a previous project in which she brought people together from different belief systems and got them to play music together in a way to sort of bridge the conflict. And these people were people from Israel and Palestine. So, you know, really a conflicting group of people to come together and play music and see whether that might heal some of the conflict in that region. So I decided to try to understand what is it about playing music in a group that brings people together, and does the audience see when a group of people who are playing together are more or less connected? Can the audience hear that? So that's the ensemble project is designed to investigate just that. So there's a number of components. There's a blog which I've you know, just started. I should say that I'm just back from maternity leave on April 1st. So the project is just ramping up again. But essentially, that's one component where I will blog about these different scientific, what we know from science in terms of music and its relationship to empathy and connectedness. And then with my string quartet that I work with called Vocalective, we went into the recording studio last fall and we recorded the same pieces of music under different conditions. So sometimes we were looking at each other and we had eye contact. Sometimes we had our backs to each other, so we had no eye contact and we just had to rely on our ears. Sometimes we played with no dynamics or no tempo changes, et cetera. And each of these takes will be available on the site so that people can go in and they can evaluate to the extent that they think that that particular take is musical or not.
What is the site?
It's called theensembleproject.com.
Oh.
Right now we just have one of the first performance takes that I call it, sort of a take in which we didn't have any artificial rules to follow. And after each take, each of the musicians also rated how much they felt connected to one another. And once I have a few people that have gone in and done their own ratings, I will also then show what the musicians thought of their performances. And that way sort of start a dialogue about what it is that, you know, makes people find music compelling when it's played in a group and how that relates to our sense of empathy.
Well, let's backtrack. Speaking of empathy, you said you're just back from maternity leave. What kind of baby do you have?
I have a boy baby.
Oh. And how old?
His name is Alexander Julius, and he's just 3 months now. He was born in January.
So this is your first baby?
He is my first.
Well,
yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you. My husband say we're one and done, but we'll see about that.
Now, of course, to be in part of Chris Johnson's book about the meaning of life in a godless universe, everybody in that book is an atheist or a non-believer. What's your background and what's your story?
I was raised Catholic. In fact, I went to Catholic school from the time I was in elementary school all the way through the end of high school.
In Toronto.
And my family was, you know, we went to church every Sunday. My mother is the music director of a Catholic church in Toronto, where I grew up. And I didn't consider myself particularly religious growing up, but I've recently had the opportunity to look back at the diary that I wrote from ages about 11 to 15, and boy, was I religious. You know, every few pages, there's some reference to God and my beliefs. And so looking back on that, it's really interesting to sort of read this completely different perspective from where I stand today. I can't tell you where I lost my faith exactly, except to say that finally when I co-hosted a television show on the Oprah Winfrey Network called Miracle Detective, it was a show in which I was the scientific foil to Believer in Miracles, and we went around the country and we sort of investigated people's claims of miracles, everything from stigmata to, you know, statues dripping oil, etc.
I saw one of those, the speaking in tongues one.
Oh, right. Yeah, the glossolalia episode. So it wasn't until I got attacked by people who claimed that they were Christians over and over and over again via email after doing that show that I really felt that I needed to stand up and say, look, you know, I'm an atheist and I don't believe in this and that needs to be okay. I hadn't labeled myself as an atheist until that moment, until I was actually attacked by the Christian, you know, populace. And of course, not everyone. Most of the people I met were very kind and very nice and, you know, were great people. But this kind of very verbal, loud minority of Christians that I felt behaved so un-Christian-like made me just want to disassociate myself from that entire group.
Well, we will talk, come back with Indra Visconda and talk about what brings you joy next. That's part of Chris Johnson's book. But we want to take a break.
Well, let's go to this segment listening to Indra Visconda singing the beginning of a gorgeous piece of music. We can't hear the whole thing. It's called Lua Descolorida. It's by an Argentinian composer, Osvaldo Golijov, if I said that right. A very sad piece talking about empathy and feelings based on some poetry. And I think it's Indra's voice and string quartet from the Ensemble Project. Welcome back to Free Thought Radio. I'm Dan Barker.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor, and that we were playing just a little bit of Chanson Perpetuelle by Chausson. That is our guest singing, Indra Visconda. She's not only an opera singer, she's a scientist, an educator, a new mother, and an atheist. And you may have caught her as the skeptic on Miracle Detectives, which was ran on the Oprah Winfrey Network in 2011. So welcome back to Free Thought Radio, Indra.
Thank you.
You also host a blog, a radio blog called Inquiring Minds, and that's a science blog, right? A podcast,
yeah.
I'm sorry. Science, a podcast.
Yes, that's right. So Chris Mooney and I co-hosted, and the first 10 minutes or so of the podcast is us talking about the news of the week in science, and then there's a long-form interview, which one of us has done with a intellectual or a big thinker or a scientist.
Wow. So you've probably talked about gravity waves in the most recently.
We did. We had Phil Plait, the bad astronomer, on the show to help us dissect what happened at Bicep 2.
So everybody's getting heavier, I guess, now that we found their gravity waves. Well, it's waves and it's vibrations, and music is a vibration that somehow our brain enjoys hearing. What is the connection between the neurons in the brain and actual enjoyment of music?
Well, the relationship is somewhat complex, but it's not much different from what happens when you enjoy other activities. So we can see when we put people in the scanner and they're listening to music that they love, we can see that the reward centers in their brain get active, just like they would be if they're doing something else pleasurable. But what's really interesting to me is that oftentimes when we see people's brains when they're listening to music that they really appreciate and love, their brains are kind of mimicking what it would be like were they putting themselves into the shoes of the musicians who are in the music. So it's called the mirror neuron system, which is essentially a circuit of brain regions that mirror what we see someone else do. And it's the same system that goes awry in people with autism and the same system that seems to underlie our capacity for empathy. And so that's what's really compelling to me about music, is being able to, you know, trigger that system in the people that are listening to me sing so that they can relate to what I'm doing and also help them find catharsis if there's something emotional that they're trying to struggle through in their own lives.
It's interesting that, like, for example, in the audience listening to a very beautiful, sad, even tragic piece of music in this minor key, and when it's done, the audience erupts into cheering and bravo. You know, that one part of the brain is identifying with this crying, but the other part is appreciating the art behind it.
Absolutely, and that's why it's so complex. And so we can't just say, you know, what part of your brain is involved in listening to and appreciating music. Because, of course, we can also listen to music in many different ways, right? We can use it just to pump us up when we're trying to get a good workout. We can use it for catharsis. We can be active listeners in a concert hall or passive listeners in a retail shop. So, of course, our brain is active in different ways in each of these different situations.
Richard Dawkins, in his book Unweaving the Rainbow, makes a plea. I'm sure you've seen his work. A plea for integrating more science into the arts to make science more palatable and acceptable. And music is a good way to do that, isn't it?
Yeah, I certainly think so. And I think, in fact, what's really interesting is that a lot of scientists have some kind of passion for music as well, as opposed to many of the other artistic domains. And I think that's partly because music and math have a very close relationship, and it's, music is very abstract. But also, I think that, you know, music is so universal, and there's so many different ways to appreciate music. So it has such a wide swath in which it can reach people.
Now, what is happening in the brain when music triggers empathy, if you can say that?
Well, as I mentioned, it's probably relying on this mirror neuron system that seems to have evolved when, our brains were getting bigger because we were living in social groups and we had to learn to navigate these social relationships. So there are some neuroscientists like Steven Pinker, for example, who say that music is just auditory cheesecake, right? So, you know, we evolved to appreciate fats and sugars, but we didn't evolve to eat cheesecake. It just turns out that cheesecake hits all the things that we love. And so he claims music is the same, has the same effect. But there is a whole other set of neuroscientists that feel that there's something more primal about music, that in fact maybe music is even predates language as a way of communicating, and that through music, that's really sort of the first way in which we interact with people. And certainly when I talk to my three-month-old baby, it's much more that I'm singing to him than actually talking to him.
Oh, yeah.
You know, So that's compelling to me. Mm-hmm.
You probably know that the caves in Europe, in France, that have all the cave paintings, somebody discovered that the most elaborate caves are also the most acoustically pleasing caves. So they speculate there must have been a lot more going on in there than just painting on the walls.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating speculation. Of course, as a good skeptic, I would say, you know, we don't have any evidence.
Yeah, we can't go back, but they would have...
You know,
they would have been drumming or singing or humming or who knows what. they were human beings.
Yeah, who knows what? I mean, certainly they probably were making noise. That seems to be something that we humans like to do.
Now, in when you were interviewed by Chris Johnson for this book, A Better Life, looking at 100 atheists and what brings joy and meaning in their life, you said that joy comes in specific moments, but meaning comes from the long-term relationships we have with other people. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, that's how I feel. I mean, I see joy as kind of these bursts of, you know, ecstasy that we get. You know, the first time my baby smiled, boy, was that a joyful moment. But, you know, the meaning in my life tends to be something that has developed over time. You know, my husband once told me when we started dating 10 years ago that I could never compete initially with a girlfriend that he had for a number of years because they had shared so many more experiences. But that once he and I had shared that same sort of number of experiences or you know, that amount of change in life, that nothing could break that bond. And I didn't believe him at first, and now I think he's exactly right, is that the bond that you have, that you make with people, is developed over time. And that, to me, is what is meaningful in my life.
Well, listen to our guest, Indra Visconti's podcast.
And Inquiring Minds.
Inquiring Minds, and we're out of time. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We also want to thank our pinch hitter again, Mike Pilch, for fitting in for Dave McCann. You can learn all you want to know about FRF Radio at our website, ffrf.org/news/radio.
Ask for more information at ffrf.org. You can phone 1-800-335-4021 or just go to our website and join us, and we will have the April issue out if you want a complimentary copy to check us out, but I think you'll like us. And tune in next week. We'll have more Rational Radio, Blasphemous Broadcasting. Liz Felker will be our guest.
Free Thought Radio is a production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, ffrf.org. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews brought to you by Annie Laurie Gaylor and Dan Barker. I hope someday